I don't know if this is well. I'm going to bring the book back into it if I can. How much of the shift that's happening involves a westernization of the culture?
Another great question. I think you're on fire.
I think probably zero to none.
Okay.
Really?
Not as good of a question as I thought.
Not, yeah, but a surprising answer.
Yeah.
Okay,
sure. Probably zero to none.
You think that, really? What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of American Daisies. I'm Arjun.
I'm Aka.
We're here at the United Nations, which is overwhelming.
Most nervous we've ever been.
I mean, we are way over our head with this current interview. But we have on the guest someone that Akash's man crush, Dr. Sony, introduced us to. He's not even going to argue with me on this. This is amazing.
I was just busy thinking about his eyes.
We have on our guest, as our guest this week, Soumni Sengupta. She is the bureau chief for the New York Times, currently for the United Nations. Before that, she was the bureau chief for India and South Asia. All of South Asia?
Pretty much.
And then before that, it was West and Central and West Africa?
Africa. Yep, 20 countries.
I mean, 20 countries sounds insane amount of countries to be responsible for.
Of course, but, you know, I probably only made it to, I don't know, 14 of those 20 countries.
Only.
Yeah. And some of those were very, very active. So this was during the Liberian Civil War. This was when Darfur had first kicked up.
Yeah.
I went to the Democratic Republic of the Congo quite a bit because there was a very active conflict in the east of that country. So it was just, you know, jumping from one super interesting but often heartbreaking story to...
That was actually a question I had. I read that you had done work in Darfur and the Congo and Liberia, and I was wondering, did you ever feel like your safety was in jeopardy? Like, in my mind, we think of these countries as like, you're looking at me like I'm crazy, but we think of these countries like, it shit's going down all the time. That's the way we look at it as Americans.
Yeah, they were countries at war.
Right.
But I'm not like, you know, I'm not like one of those war correspondents that like runs to danger. I know how to keep myself pretty safe. I don't see any glory in just kind of putting myself in harm's way just to be able to tell the story about it later. What I think is really valuable about being a journalist in conflict zones is to tell stories about ordinary people. They could be you or me. They could be our parents. They could be our children who are just caught up, you know, in the crosshairs of a terrible war. So that's how I've always approached writing about war, and I've done plenty of it, but I'm not the one that relishes sort of embedding with soldiers or rebels. I see much more value in the kind of reporting that I do in telling stories about regular people, about civilians, you know, and what conflict does to their lives. So I was in Iraq, for example, in the summer of 2004, just a few months after the U.S. invasion. And I remember, like, my favorite story, the one that I found most gratifying, was a story about teenage girls and how the U.S. invasion had transformed their lives, you know.
Wow.
It meant that one of them, who came from a pretty privileged family, she used to wear great clothes and go to the Baghdad Club every Sunday and go for a swim. Like, suddenly she couldn't do that anymore. You know, and there was another girl whose family was in really deep poverty, and suddenly she was forced to go to work, like working at a beauty salon. So I tell you that story just because that wasn't traditional war reporting, but it was really the story of just ordinary kids, you know, and how their adolescence was completely turned upside down by war.
Right.
As there's been a lot talked about the corporatization of news, and as people are trying to get readership and newspapers are, when there's such a focus, I feel like oftentimes we hear and we experience that there's not a lot of news coverage given to outside countries. When you are a bureau chief, is that hard to confront? Is that, do you have to create priorities? Do you have to triage in a way that you might, like, how do you navigate that? Or did you have to? Maybe I'm wrong.
Sure. I mean, as a journalist, you're always making choices about what is newsy that day or that week. And sometimes, look, it's a no-brainer. So right. I was in India during the 2008 terror attacks in Mumbai, right, at the hotels.
Right.
So, of course, I mean, I was in Delhi when that first started going down, and I flew immediately to Mumbai. Like, that's not a choice.
Right.
You know that's news. The world needs to know about it. You go and cover it. You know, at other times, you sort of say, okay, what is my priority? What do I think is the most important story to tell at this moment about this vast patch of, say, a continent
or, right.
You know, a country as vast as India? Yes, we're making choices all the time, but that's, you know, I've been a journalist for 20 years, so... you know, I've got that spidey sense about what I think might be a good story. I don't know what the story might be exactly, but I've got some questions. So that's what I go and chase.
Right. Well, one of the reasons that we were excited to talk with you also is because you have just released a book. It was March, correct? March that it came out?
That's right. Yeah, it was published in early March.
The End of Karma.
My first book.
Your first book.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Long in the making, man. I'm so relieved.
When was it? When was the inception of this idea for this book?
You know, I was still in India when I decided I wanted to write a book, partly because there were just stories that I was interested in telling that I hadn't been able to tell yet for the newspaper. There were just questions that I was interested in. And I wasn't quite done, you know, I wasn't quite done exploring what was happening in India at that moment. And it became pretty clear to me that I wanted to tell the story of young people in India because India is such a starkly young country. I mean, you can feel it. Mm-hmm. I could feel it because everywhere I went, I was being called auntie. I was going to the nail salon, I was going to the cafe, it was like... I am so not your auntie, but, you know, by Indian standards, of course, I am very much an auntie because the median age in India is, what, like 27 now?
Wow.
India has the largest concentration of young people anywhere in the world, probably at any time in recorded history. So that instantly became the focus of the book. And in answer to your question, I've probably first started reporting it sometime around... 2010.
Okay.
You know, late 2009, early 2010, and then finished it at some point last year, and then it took a while for the book to be produced.
Of course.
Yeah.
And it's called The End of Karma, Hope and Fury Among India's Young.
Yep.
I just wanted that title was it's a really interesting
That's
title.
That's what I wanted to ask. Why that title?
So The End of Karma signals what I found to be a real meme, you know, in India today, which is that young people are trying to overcome their past in all kinds of ways.
Mm-hmm.
They're born with one destiny. They're trying to make another. So that's what The End of Karma is signaling. Hope and Fury, because that process of trying to overcome your past is an incredibly hopeful moment for India, because there are so many people with such high expectations. But when those expectations are not met, that can also create just huge frustration and fury. So there's plenty of hope in the book, in the stories, and there's plenty of fury.
Now, it's interesting. When you talk about just getting rid of past, I was thinking about Kejriwal and the Aam Aadmi Party from a standpoint of that it sounded like he was really trying to reach back to Nehru in this really interesting way politically, and that seemed to respond that, like, a lot of the youth, when I was just there in 2013, and a lot of, like, my cousins and their friends were really attached to that party. How does that line up with, like, getting rid of past? I'm still trying to understand that sort of concept.
Mm-hmm. Well, his message was against corruption.
Mm-hmm.
That was his main goal. That was his main sort of campaign promise was, you know, to root out all these corrupt politicians. In those elections, as you remember, the Aam Aadmi Party did not do very well.
No.
They were popular among some section of youth. And one of the people I write about was his social media manager. He's one of the young people I profile in the book. But in the end, you know, he did not, Kejriwal and his party didn't do very well in those parliamentary elections. In fact, many young people chose to vote for Mr. Modi. And Mr. Modi got a huge mandate during those parliamentary elections. However, when the state elections came along in the next few months in Delhi and Bihar,
then you saw
Kejriwal doing very, very well in the Delhi state election. There was one more thing I was going to say. I think that what I'm really struck by now in India at this moment, like in the last month, month and a half, what you're really seeing on college campuses across India are young people kind of finding a voice. And it started in Delhi. It started on the Jawaharlal Nehru University campus, where a young student leader named Kanhaiya Kumar gave a speech basically defending his fellow students' right to free speech, right? There had been some campus demonstrations. Some slogans had been shouted for Kashmiri independence. There was a debate on campus about the use of the death penalty against Kashmiri, against two Kashmiri suspects. And Kanhaiya Kumar got up at the podium and he spoke in favor of his fellow students' right to free speech. He was arrested and charged with sedition. He was beat up on his way to court by some guys who didn't like what he said. When he was released several weeks later, I think about 3 weeks later, he gave quite a striking speech on the JNU campus in which he talked very much about freedom. And he talked about, first, the freedom to speak out, the freedom to air even unpopular political opinions. But then he started talking about other kinds of freedom. He started talking about the freedom of women to choose what they want to wear, right, the freedom of women to be out on the streets and feel safe, the freedom to practice your religion. And at one point he even said, you know, the freedom of people of all persuasions, including LGBT people. So right, he suddenly sort of took this message of freedom and really kind of stretched it out. And I think in his remarks and the rallying of young people around student leaders like him, in many ways, shows exactly what I'm trying to say in the book, which is that this young generation has these demands that they're placing on Indian on the Indian state and on Indian society, and their demands are sort of revealing some of the big fault lines, you know, in Indian society.
It's fascinating. I would like to explore a little bit about you. From what I read, you were born in India.
Yep.
And you grew up, but also grew up in Canada and the United States. So you have an interesting perspective for us that we're interested in, because you grew up in all the three mainlands that we talk about and that we're exploring this podcast. Was it immensely different in all three places?
So my parents had this great idea to go from a really big, hot, swampy city called Calcutta to a tiny little village in the middle of Canada where it snowed for 6 months of the year, called Selkirk, Manitoba. And it was so small that for long weekends, when we wanted to see the big city, we would take a road trip to Minneapolis.
Wow.
That was the closest big city.
Wow.
So we stayed there for 3 years, and then we drove down from Midwestern Canada all the way to California, because my parents had some friends in California. They decided that it was going to be warmer and nicer.
What were those 3 years like, though? Was that a big adjustment? I mean, you're coming from...
You know, when you're a kid, like, I had just turned 8 when we came to Canada. So, I don't know. I mean, I think my approach was just to, like, okay, here we are. Here's this new place.
Were there a lot of Indians in Selkirk?
Yeah, there were Native Americans in Selkirk.
Oh, the other Indians.
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
but there wasn't
absolutely
a lot of South Asians.
Oh, no. Oh, right. There were, like, none.
Why did
I
they...
mean, me and my cousin were the only two Indians for miles, I think.
Was it a job opportunity? Was it, well, I'm trying to... What,
no, my
what was
uncle,
that?
My dad's older brother, had right come a few years earlier. So we came because he said, hey, come on down.
Right.
There's this great little village in Midwestern Canada where it snows 6 months out of the year. What's not
right
to like? So we stayed across the street. We stayed first in his apartment with my uncle, my aunt, and my cousin. And the thing I remember, like, most of all, is that right across the street from us was this mental asylum.
That's good.
So
right.
It was, yes. So as I say in the book, you know, there was a field of snow separating the madness on their side from the hubris on ours.
That's good.
This is why we're talking to a writer right now. That was a nice turn of phrase. I like that. So then you went down to California.
Then we went down to California.
That must have been a big shift as well.
You know, I moved to a different city, to a different school, pretty much every single year until I got to high school.
Ah.
So for me, it was like, okay.
This is just
how we roll, you know? Yeah.
How did you identify then? I'm sorry to interrupt, but did you identify as Indian the whole time, or did you feel American at a certain point? Did you feel Canadian pretty quickly?
Well, I guess I wasn't. I'm sure I didn't know.
Right.
I'm sure I didn't know. I'm sure also, you know, back then I thought about it probably less than,
right,
you know, a generation that came up after me.
Yeah.
You know, I was just this weird kid with a weird name with big hair, you know, whose parents spoke this other language. And
did you guys speak?
We spoke Bangla at home.
Oh, you spoke Bangla,
which
at home
kind of over the years then became Benglish.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, in answer to your question, which is a really good one.
I'd be asking a good question. Tarzan talks a lot, you don't say nothing.
Well, you're like chewing on those good
I'm
questions.
I'm doing it.
Cogitating.
Oh,
yeah.
I'd be cogitating my ass off. I'd be saying that.
So, at some point, we came to California. There were a few more Indians, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there were.
Had
enough. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Enough for my parents to, like, start doing the whole Durga Puja thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So there were enough, not just enough South Asians, but they were Bengali Hindus, you
right
know, from Calcutta to put on, you know, the annual festival. And then when I got to college, it was only really when I got to UC Berkeley that I discovered that there were lots of other kids like me, you know,
yeah,
that I wasn't the only, yeah, weird one around.
So. I mean, you said you got to Canada when you were 8.
Mm-hmm.
But what was your big memories from the time, those first few years? Do you have big memories?
From India?
Yeah, when you were in India. I'm always fascinated by the things that we hold on to from the early
right
years. Like, what were those?
Right. Very few, because I think my strategy, I probably have a really bad memory to begin with, but I think my strategy was just to draw the curtain and say, okay, look ahead, move on.
That was your defense because you were
probably
moving
because
so much,
we were
right
moving around so
yeah
much.
Right, that's
but
true.
But of course, there are things that stay with you.
Right.
And one of the memories that really, really sticks in my mind is when my grandfather was losing his eyesight. He was going blind just as I was learning how to read.
Oh.
And so one of my distinct memories, and I'm sure this is an imperfect memory, but I remember being summoned into his room and ordered to read the newspaper because he was a news junkie. And I could maybe manage to read a headline or maybe the first paragraph of a story.
Yeah.
But I think there was something about that and his obsession with the news. You know, he would go out to his front stoop every afternoon and all his old buddies from the neighborhood would come around and they would argue about what they had all read in the newspaper that day.
Yeah.
Right. And this was their thing.
Right.
Yeah. So as a little kid watching this, some seed must have been planted in my head that, you
the
know,
romantic in me wants that
the
to
news,
be true.
Yeah, I mean, probably some little seed was planted in my head that, look, the news matters. The news is important. And no one in my family became a journalist. We didn't know anybody who was a journalist, either in India or in this country. But I sort of, you know, found my way into the news business.
Well, it's a good segue because I actually was wondering about that. Was because, you know, we talk a lot about the parents' generation or the generation that came about, and like, you know, he's a comic, I'm an actor, and we've talked a lot about the friction or say the pushback that we got going into those fields. Journalism to me feels like a professional, like sort of safe sort of thing. Was that something that was widely accepted by your family? Or did you get pushback, or what was your experience with that when you said, "Hey, I'm going to be a journalist"?
Certainly back then, and I've been a journalist for 20 years.
Right.
But when I was first getting into the business, there were very few South Asians. I certainly didn't know any. I mean, I started discovering others later on, but I think that we've all had to, all of us in this room have had to find our calling and just go through that door, right? Or cut that door in the fence and go through it. Mm-hmm. So for me, you know, I landed in a newsroom and I knew that I was like fish in water. You know, these were the people that I wanted to be with. This was what I wanted to do.
They use words like cogitating.
See what?
They use words like cogitating.
Something like that. Yeah.
Words you could get behind.
And I'd never gone to journalism school. So No, I didn't go to journalism school.
That's surprising. So how did that happen?
I didn't take a journalism class. Well, I was an English major and I majored in English and development studies at Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of planning to become an academic, but I wasn't so sure about that. I took some time off. I did this and that. And then somebody suggested a training program at the Los Angeles Times. And at the time, the LA Times was, and many other newsrooms were trying to diversify their newsrooms because they just had a bunch of white guys in there. So there was this training program, and I somehow got in. Like, I had no business getting into that training program, but I did. And I had these incredible mentors in the newsroom who sort of threw me, you know, at stories. They told me, go there, get that story, come back, try to put it together. And, you know, I learned on the job. But it was really like discovering, oh, yeah, I mean, this is what I need to do in the world. Like, this is just what I need to do. I am going to get paid badly, but I'm still going to get paid to go and ask questions of people. You know, and like knock on their doors and get into their lives and try to make meaning and tell different stories about people in different walks of life. You know, I mean, so in a way, not belonging, not knowing what I was, jumping around from one world to another prepared me perfectly, like prepared my soul, I think, to do this work.
So did you... This is going to require, did you, at this point in time, you'd been in America since you went to California, like you were, did you feel pretty Americanized at this point?
Yeah, I guess so.
You didn't feel, feel like an outsider. Did you feel like an outsider? I guess
yeah, because like, you know, I couldn't, my parents wouldn't let me go out on a date. I went to the Sadie Hawkins dance, my dad picked me up, you know, like.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I was a total weirdo, yeah.
So I guess I'm wondering, was there cultural things that you had to navigate once you got into the workplace that were hard or made more difficult because you were South Asian?
Probably. Like, I remember going to these fancy parties at the homes of friends in college, right, who came from far wealthier, more sophisticated families. And I discovered that there was cheese that wasn't wrapped in plastic, you know, in those like craft slices,
cheese,
right?
Dog, I don't get it.
So, you know, there was like, okay, then like just learning how to
navigate that
world of privilege and all of that. Sure, that required some learning.
But nothing also, like we were talking to an agent who was, you know, someone that didn't drink a lot, and he would have to go to these like networking parties for as an agent like that, and he was like struggling with the fact that he didn't really drink, and like people were thinking that he was weird because he doesn't drink, and how he has.
I've never
like,
had that problem.
Okay. All right, then there you go.
That's not a problem that I personally experienced.
All right, but like stuff like that just like kind of came up. But it sounds like, you know, you shut down my question.
The world is like a rich and weird and wondrous place. And sometimes you go into rooms that you've never been in.
Right.
And, you know, it can be mind-blowing. It can be disorienting. But, you know, that's what the world offers. And I'm in this incredibly privileged, blessed position to be able to go from room to room. So,
to that point, I had this question. You say you try to find meaning and assess situations and all that. How do you think Indians in India view India? Because I think of as us, we view India with kind of like this reverence and like, yeah, we know there's problems, but that's, you know, like, I feel like that's home. I've only been twice, but to me, that's home. And I was wondering how they differ in their view of India.
Look, it's a country of nearly 1.3 billion people.
Right.
So I don't think it's possible to make a generalization about how they view their whole country. I think that by and large, Indians are very, very good at calling a spade, you know. It's a vibrant democracy, and so Indian citizens have proven to be really tough on calling their leaders to task, holding their feet to the fire, throwing out politicians who don't deliver. The press is incredibly dogged and critical. Not all the time, not always, but often enough.
Right.
So I don't think that it's hard for me to sort of draw a big generalization
in
about,
your experience.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this then, because it is interesting. So then you went back, it was 2005 when you went to New Delhi, right?
Yeah.
To be the bureau chief. So that had been, I don't know, some years since you had left.
30 years, exactly.
30 years since you had left. So
yeah.
You went
we left
back.
In 75.
You came back, it was been 30 years. What was that like? Going back, what was did you feel? Him and I have a similar. I go back pretty frequently, and I lived there for a year. And there's something about the roots there. There's something about every time I go there. There's something that I feel. Maybe it's just that I'm reflected more by like that. I just see people that look like me more.
Right.
Right. That like makes a difference in my life, or something that makes me feel really grounded and centered in a way. What was the experience like then going back? But I'm only there for like a few weeks. What was it going back there, living there, then working there, then navigating the politics and office politics, or just like life there? What was that like?
Yeah. I mean, this thing about like seeing people who look like you can be really profound because they're probably looking at you and not thinking that you look like them. You know, they probably recognize that you are much more privileged, much wealthier, different, walk different, talk different, are dressed in different clothes. I certainly found myself sometimes, you know, being in the city looking at like one of the many construction sites, you know, in Delhi or something, and looking at a woman, thin woman, you know, rail thin, looking like a skeleton wrapped in a sari, carrying a bucket of construction material on her head, right? Because on those construction sites, the women are often kind of the mules, right? Carrying things from one place to the other. And I remember distinctly thinking, wow, I could have been born her, right? I mean, it's just an accident of birth that I'm sitting in this car, you know, in this air-conditioned car looking at her.
We just heard this term on another interview like an hour ago, birth lottery. We won the birth lottery of being born.
We interviewed this guy, Anish Patel, who started this organization called Uplift Humanity, taking teenage volunteers to India to work with juvenile delinquents out there. And he was talking about, you know, the 16-year-olds that go over from here to there. It's literally just a lottery, like that they were born here instead of in India, because they could have ended up just like that.
So that's a profound moment, you know, when you're surrounded by people who look like you and you realize how different your life and your life chances have been. Look, I lived in India for six and a half years almost. And man, was I happy when I came back. Like came back to the U.S. and I could like drink the tap water. Like, you know, that was.
Did you stay? Did you stay not tap water the entire time?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I had a water filter.
Right, you had the filter, but you never just...
I had the filter, but...
You never took the plunge?
You just
never take the plunge?
No, right. No, I wasn't going to drink the deli tap water. But I would also go back as a kid, right? Every 3 or 4 years, I would go back for the summer with the family. And we would always go back to Calcutta, and we would always stay with our relatives. And it was only really a small little section of India that I knew. But then when I went back as a journalist, of course, I knew I could explore. I could go to many, many more places.
Did you have myths that you had built up just from the small subset of times and like spaces that you were in that then got broken down as you became a journalist? Ooh, she's thinking because that was a good question. I got one.
Look on my face. I'm gonna think more about that. Are there myths that got broken? I'm sure there were. I can't think of a really good one.
I will just say that I feel that I romanticize India in this way, and I'm very aware of that from a standpoint. I romanticize the idea of family and like the community structure, and that there's a grass is greener element that I bring when I think about India and like what I want to bring here from a standpoint of what I feel like I've lost by not being there. And then I go there and I'm confronted when I see the reality of the situation. Sometimes I'm like, wow, this family structure. But yeah, sure, brothers haven't talked in 15 years because of stuff that went on. Like, you know, so there's like ways that there are cracks to that. And so that would maybe be the biggest thing. Like the idea of a joint family house is a romanticized idea I have that would be amazing in my head. And then I've seen it not work a number of times, but in my head it still romanticizes a way that I think that would be a really beautiful way of like living. So I guess that would be my only example.
I was so surprised to come when I came back to the US and I was hearing about these houses that had in-law units in the back. Have you heard of this? It's basically like a little house that you have in the back for your in-laws to move into, because then they can help you with, you know, the childcare whatever. Right. So I kept thinking of it as like the Indianization of America, you know.
Which is so interesting, because then I was in Bangalore, and this was the last time I was there, and I was seeing advertisements for like single family houses that were moving away from that in an interesting way.
Because people are moving to the city, women are working, they want more freedom, they don't want their, you know, mothers-in-law and sisters-in-law and fathers-in-law to restrict their movement necessarily. I mean, you know, every society goes through changes. No society is static, and especially a country like India, which is so diverse and undergoing such transformation. There's no reason to think that it would remain static.
I don't know if this is real. I'm going to bring the book back into it if I can. How much of the shift that's happening involves a Westernization of the culture?
Another great question. I
think probably zero to none.
Okay.
Really?
Not as good of a question not as I thought.
But a surprising answer.
Yeah.
God, okay.
Probably zero to none.
Really?
You know, I mean, India has been forever so great at just, you know, taking what is useful, what is cool, what's interesting, and then making it Indian. So I don't think it's necessarily, you know, Western. I mean, is having an in-law unit in the back of your house, is that, I mean, I was joking earlier, is that Indian? No, it just like is a thing that kind of works for a lot of American families now.
Sure, but I would like, that's not a Western concept. I mean, it's like being a I think that I would say that
Westernism with nuclear families.
Yeah, and like that's individual a
new Western,
relation.
But that's a new Western idea, right? That's a relatively new Western idea. Western societies have changed. There were times when there were, multi-generational families, both rich and poor, living under one roof. That has changed with industrialization, with urbanization, with changes in the economy and in the labor force.
So you're breaking down an idea that there's an Eastern modality and a Western modality.
I think it's too simple. I think that's too simplistic. And I also think that India has been just so deft at absorbing and just making it Indian, right? I mean, you go to a fast food restaurant in India that you might think of as being really Western, but then they're offering some special fasting menu or something, you know, for
chicken
like...
Maharaja make.
Well, there's that. Yeah, there's also that.
I'm still stuck on that. You are breaking down literally like what I would consider a duality. You said that there's not really.
I think it's just more. I think it's not that simple. You know, I think I think it's not that simple. And, you know, our cultures have influenced one another for a really long time. You know, we are not immune to each other's cultural influences. Our languages have, have crept into one another's language. Indian English is a distinctly different version of English, and it's thriving.
So you're striking. What is fascinating to hear, because you're striking at something that Akash and I have talked about, is this maybe this false concern, but this concern that there's something that's going to be lost by South Asian Americans here, like losing a sense of what it means to be Indian, And I guess there's been parts that I've been worried that there might be a loss of what it means to be India in India. But you're just saying that it's just going to keep shifting and that it's just going to keep changing.
Countries change. Cultures change.
There's like an essential thing to a thing? You don't think that a culture has an essential quality?
I don't. I think the essential quality of human civilization is to, is to grow and change, and also to be distinct. Sure.
But the way in which you grow has an intention, correct? So I think that if I was talking about modern day Western civilization, the intention to grow has a lot to do with individual success versus what I would say that what I grew up with, my mentality of the Eastern thought was community growth. And so that to me would be a difference that I would say, and I don't know how to further what I'm saying, but doesn't that stand to say that those cultures have differences?
I think there's plenty of evidence that, that in our own families, right? I mean, isn't individual success also promoted, right?
Yeah, but like individual success, like part of the reason our professions got frowned upon is because the family doesn't look as good as they do when someone is a doctor. I can make more money than a doctor, but the family doesn't look as successful. So the community is like, yeah.
Except I bet in India, if you were going to be an actor or a comic, right?
Yeah, I would be beaten severely.
Well, I don't know.
By my family in India.
And by your family in India. But there's great comics, and, it's got the biggest film industry in the world. So clearly there are some Indians who are encouraging their children to be in the movie business.
Sure.
Those are usually within that family, though.
Yeah.
Not always.
Not always,
no,
for sure.
Not always. I mean, there are lots of, there are lots of outsiders who have come into the arts, of course. Partly that's what my book is really exploring.
Mm-hmm.
So I tell the story of the son of an auto rickshaw driver in Patna who definitely does not want to be an auto rickshaw driver and who does not become an auto rickshaw driver. He has a great job in finance. He totally, remakes his destiny. I talk about a girl, the daughter of Dhobis, Varsha. Her family has been in the business of washing other people's clothes and then pressing other people's clothes for generations.
So here's what I would say to
that. She definitely does not want to be in that business, She wants to do something else.
I'm sorry, here's what I would say to that. Varsha, I remember you talking about this, her in another interview that I was listening to of yours. She, for generations, they were Dobies, right? Mm-hmm. So for the first time, someone is stepping outside of that and saying no, which is kind of to what we thought it was, where there's this Western ideal taking place where, whether this is good or bad, I'm not assigning a value judgment, but like, okay, I'm breaking the mold. That's kind of a Western thing, and this is very recent. Whereas before, we would associate it with an Eastern thing of like, you carry on the family tradition. Don't you think that's Westernizing?
I think this is very much part of, you know, the Indian spirit. And I think it would be wrong to call that Westernization. This is what Indians will want, to have a better life, to be themselves, you know? Right. Why is it the privilege of Westerners to have some sense of autonomy, to try and to chase a dream? You know, why is that? Why is that a Western idea?
I always associated the West with this, like the pursuit of happiness, right? The pursuit of happiness from some outside means. Eastern ideals, at least from whatever Hinduism I've learned, and I don't know much, so I'm not going to try to preach, but the Hinduism I've studied, happiness is within. You don't chase it on the outside. So this idea that this job will make me happy, no, you will make you happy. That's why we meditate. That's why we do these things. So it's not like, I don't think we looked at it like, oh no, you're not allowed to pursue happiness. We looked at it like, just be happy, man. What are you talking about? Pursue happiness. Not pursue happiness. Sit on a rock. Think. Clear your mind. There you go. Happiness.
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of Indian immigrants in this country also pursue a great deal of wealth. So that's not inimical to, you know, that's not necessarily something that Indians don't pursue. But just to point out, the Indian Constitution guarantees equality to all Indian citizens, to each and every Indian citizen, equality in the eyes of the law. It forbids the practice of untouchability. It promises liberty, equality, and justice. These are ideas that should be very familiar to us all. Right. You know, modern India has a modern constitution, a really remarkable one, you know, for mm-hmm. a country that was born only in 1947, that was born so poor, that was made up of so many different religions, that right. was made up of so many different languages, really a remarkable promise of equality in the eyes of the law.
I want to ask you, as we're getting close to our time, how do you self-identify at this moment now with all of your, you know, upbringings, all of your cultures mm-hmm. that you've existed within? Do you think about that now? Mm-hmm. Do you still think about it less? Are you still in that moving forward space?
You know, primarily I belong to a tribe of curious people in the world. I'm a journalist. Mm-hmm. I am a daughter of India. And the future of India matters to me very much. Mm-hmm. And I am an American citizen, and I'm American in many of my sensibilities, I know.
Right.
And you discover that when you go outside of America, you know, you really kind of begin to understand how American you are. So I'm not different in that sense. And look, I feel really excited that I get to live in this day and age, right, where no matter who we are inside or where we were born, we have the freedom to go where we want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does that answer your question or not quite?
No, I think it does. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no real right answer. There's no right or wrong to that one, because I think you talked about how you feel in that moment.
Mm.
What I love about it is it's interesting, from all that you've written and all that you've seen, there's still such a sense of optimism and hope within you, and like, you carry an energy that's very, you know, you've been a journalist in many war-torn conflict mm-hmm. zones, and you don't seem beaten down at all by like that. And you don't seem cynical or jaded, or, and maybe you are, and maybe we're just not seeing that side, but it's been kind of amazing to see that. And I think, listeners, you'll be able to hear that. Are there any final thoughts about the book or just life you want to impart, and wisdom that you want to give us?
Oh man, I am so not the wisdom dispenser, but just that, you know, I think I think it was great for me as a young person to, and I wasn't even that young when I got into journalism, but for me to like have that moment where I knew this is what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And whatever it took, even if I was the only one in the newsroom that looked like me, mm-hmm. You know, whose name nobody could pronounce, you know, I was one of the, there were not a lot of women foreign correspondents. There were some, but not a lot, right? When I started out, certainly not many women of color. I'm really grateful that I somehow stumbled into that thing that I really wanted to do, you know, that gave my life meaning. And so I just hope like everybody gets to do that, you know, for most of their lives, if not for all of their lives. So you might be 40 when you discover that. You might be 52 when you discover that. But that's like, I think a really, I don't know, like that's the thing, you know, like that's the rasa, you know, there's a word in Sanskrit, right? That's the thing.
Right. Well, beautiful. Guys, you can, it's Soumini Sengupta on Twitter. What is
that? Soumini Sengupta on Twitter.
That's and, you know, she writes for the New York Times, so find that on the interwebs.
Buy her book, The End of Karma, The Hope and Fury of India's Young.
Correct? Thanks for the plug.
Of course. I'm sure our thousand of listeners will be thrilled.
Really shift your... this interview just got you a house. You don't know yet, but that's what just happened. Thank you so much for being on the show. Guys, what are we telling them? Oh, yeah, share this on Facebook. That's the best way.
We keep talking. Comment on it. Tell us what you think.
Look, I mean, we talk about that we weren't trying to build a community, that we're talking about a community, and we want to hear from you. So please keep reaching out to us on Facebook, on Twitter. You can also email us, AmericanDaisiesPodcast@gmail.com. But look, man, we are only as strong as the community we are building, and we'd love for you guys to be a part of that and continue to be in our world. So
rate the podcast. I don't know why he talks so much. Just rate the podcast 5 stars. I don't even know what we're doing all this stuff for. Rate the podcast 5 stars. If they make you comment, just write bruh. BRUH... That's enough. People will be like, what is this mysterious podcast that everybody's going crazy over?
I'm Arjun.
I'm Akash.
We'll catch you in a couple days.
God bless.